Central Time. I'm Rob Fair. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, several listeners asked us through WPR's Why Scottson project where the Wah part of many Wisconsin place names comes from and what it means. Think Wausau, Milwaukee, and so on. We talked to a pair of native language experts for some answers. Now, did you watch A Charlie Brown Christmas in the last month? Did you watch it multiple times? Every year, millions of viewers tune in to see Charlie Brown pick the saddest little tree on the lot and hear Linus explain the true meaning of Christmas by reading from the Gospel of Luke.
You shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men."
So what is it about Charlie Brown and the rest of the Peanuts gang that has people coming back for more? It's not just the big holiday TV specials and the 18,000 daily comic strips as well. For many, it's identifying deeply with one or more of the characters, often in different ways as a child and then later as an adult. In the book called The Peanuts Papers, writers and cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and the gang and the meaning of life, more than 30 well-known writers and artists, including Jonathan Franzen, Janice Shapiro, and Ira Glass, talk about the ways Charles Schulz's creations affected their lives and careers. Andrew Blauner is the editor of the new book. He's the founder of Blauner Books Literary Agency. His other anthologies include Coach, Brothers, The Good Book, and more. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
This was a long-running comic strip. A lot of people, myself included, grew up on it. Why do you think Peanuts and Charlie Brown and Snoopy have had this enduring popularity?
The secret of the Peanuts success, that was part of my agenda in putting this book together. It was to try to find some answers to that, because here we are 70 years removed from the start of Peanuts in 1950, 20 years removed since the time we had an original comic strip, because that's when Charles Schulz died in 2000. And there is something unquestionably transcendent, timeless, democratizing about it. Starting from presidents from Obama to Reagan down to people at the local bar or barbershop, it seems to be something that people who maybe don't agree on anything else can agree that they love Peanuts. And within that, different people have their own affections and alienations and antagonisms about it. So I don't think there's any conclusion other than it begs a question of whether we're kind of in a new Peanuts moment. And I know I'm talking to people in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, and people have sort of theorized on whether it's a coincidence or not that there is kind of a renaissance of interest in Schulz and Peanuts and also in Mr. Rogers. And they're both Midwestern guys who created these iconic, anthemic worlds that people many, many years later are still endeared by, learning from, and engaged with. So it's still a bit of a mystery, but it's a charming, life-affirming one, I think.
A running theme from a lot of the contributors to this book is that Peanuts wasn't light and funny and happy in many cases. There was a melancholy. Charlie Brown often starts a strip by saying, "I'm depressed." And he really is. He's dealing with depression and anxiety, and so are the other characters. What about this kind of bleak landscape captured us?
I think the notion is that there was something, because people have said, well, it was actually, to what you're saying, people said, well, was Peanuts actually kind of dark, especially for a comic strip? And Chris Ware, who created Jimmy Corrigan, among other things, you know, said in one of the panels related to this book, said, you know, "I'm not sure it's about being dark so much as about being real." Mm. That until Peanuts came along, comic strips were mostly kind of populated by grown-ups who were acting like children. Here, the entire universe and the entire population of the strip was children, no grown-ups. Somebody pointed out that Snoopy is the only one whose parents ever actually appear in the strip. But there's no question about it that there's a melancholy to it, and there's probably no question that that's not coincidental with the fact that Schulz himself, you know, suffered from being melancholy himself. But, you know, one of the themes is unrequited love. I mean, everyone is in love with somebody who basically doesn't love them back, which is, Schroeder and Lucy and Sally and Linus and Charlie Brown and the little redheaded girl. But, you know, the themes of life is hard and people are difficult. But the flip side of that is you know, perseverance has its value, and there's joy, you know, Snoopy's joy and wonderment, and for every disappointment, there's redemption. And, you know, if Linus is in the pumpkin patch, and you mentioned the TV specials, which was obviously a lot of people's gateway, if you want to call it that, to the world of Peanuts, you know, was Linus sitting in the in the patch waiting for the great pumpkin? Was that an act of faith, or was that naivete? I was struck listening to that intro you played of how much Linus in that great soliloquy sounds almost exactly like my 5-year-old son. Anyway.
Yeah. And it seems like, as you mentioned, this is kids acting like grown-ups. In a way, this could be a safe place in a culture that maybe didn't want to talk about our individual mental health. We could see it lived out and tackle our own issues by watching these kids with big round heads.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, Charlie Brown, never got a Valentine's card, excuse me, which I learned in the process of putting this book together engendered mass number of people actually sending Valentine's cards to Charlie Brown through the Schultz office. So yes, it gave children, I think, a lot of, I mean, it was all sort of unconscious. I don't think as kids we were sort of having this conscious thought, but it kind of validated our lives and the meaning of our lives and the experiences that we had. There's also the element that it wasn't actually constructed and contrived to be something for children. It was Peanuts was, put together by and actually Schultz, as many people may know, he detested the title Peanuts. He thought it was demeaning. he would have just as soon call it Charlie Brown. And if you asked Schultz, in his private life, what is it you do? He said, I draw that strip with Charlie Brown and Snoopy. He wouldn't even say the word Peanuts. That's how strongly he felt against it.
Talking to Andrew Blauner, editor of the book, The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang and the Meaning of Life. We asked around here at WPR. Jennifer Dargan, network assistant director, says, I love the way they did the voice of the teachers on the TV specials. It really connected with me as a kid, how I felt about being on a totally different wavelength than adults. And adults appear very close to almost never or to never in the strips. They don't even have a voice in the specials. This is just the kids. What was up with that, Andrew?
Well, it's funny. The a lot of people love that sort of teacher voice in the background. And Rick Moody, who's in the book, who's probably best known for writing The Ice Storm, has a great phrase for that. I think he calls it the trombone voice, sort of offset. This was a rare case of where it was all, I mean, and also you had no idea how old these kids were. I mean, and their parents were not around. They didn't really even have much furniture. You didn't know. They were obviously in suburbia, but we didn't know where. A lot of it was about friendship and about getting along and about cruelty, obviously, with Lucy. And, Ronald Reagan was on record that his favorite part of the whole strip was Lucy pulling the football away from Charlie Brown. And people asked Schultz, well, couldn't you have just let him kick it once? And he said, no, it wouldn't be as funny or wouldn't keep people's interest. And then the gag would be over.
Now, let's talk about the art a little bit. Very minimalist, but a couple of the cartoonists in your book, and I've seen this elsewhere, they say, you know what, as simple as it looks, it's really hard to fake. You can't draw these kids like Charles Schultz did.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's funny. The book that I put together before this one was about the Beatles, and there's sort of an analog there that I think a lot of people grew up, singing or playing an instrument and thinking, how hard could it be? And the drawing, you're right, Charlie Brown, Snoopy, there is a simplicity. I mean, there's a paradox to Peanuts. There is a simplicity, yes, to the art and to the drawing and also to the characters and the storyline. At the same time, it's complicated, and the drawing is not replicable not nearly as much as it seems to be. And the storylines and the characters obviously have a lot more depth and complexity than you might think on the surface. But yes, I made a conscious effort to include several cartoonists writing prose in this book. There are no Peanuts strips themselves reproduced in the book, but there are some artists who have written strips, original strips of their own, but also written contributed essays. And it was fascinating to read their accounts. And somebody like a Chris Ware says, every cartoonist in the world owes a debt to Charles Schultz. And some people would go further than that and say we all, those of us who've loved it and learned from it and grown from it, owe that debt.
a lot of people, just briefly, a lot of people, not just cartoonists, engage in your book very seriously with the meaning of Charlie Brown. This is clearly in some ways more than a comic strip, right?
Well, yeah, and one of the surprises to me, one of my apprehensions going in was almost that, oh, everybody's going to write about Snoopy and how much they love him, and that was far from the case. In fact, I had no idea of how much, it wasn't backlash, but like a lot of people thought that Snoopy was a narcissist and that, you know, toward the latter half of the strip that it just became too much about his Baroque behavior. And on the flip side, I can't say I was aware of how much love there is out there for Charlie Brown and how many people identified with him.
Andrew Blauner is the founder of Blauner Books Literary Agency. We're talking to him about the anthology, The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and The Meaning of Life, which he edited. And we want to hear from you. Is there a particular Peanuts comic strip that you've held on to for one reason or another? Which Peanuts character is your favorite and why? What lessons about life have you learned from the Peanuts gang? Do you share the comics and TV specials with your kids and grandkids? What makes Charles Schulz's work so special? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about how the Peanuts comic strips helped shape American culture and the lives of some well-known writers and artists. Andrew Blauner is our guest. He's founder of Blauner Books Literary Agency and editor of The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and The Meaning of Life. We asked our WPR colleagues about Charles Schulz and the Peanuts comic strips. Morning show producer Colleen Leahy says, I can recall from memory a comic that illustrates perfectly why I love Peanuts. Linus is looking at his hands, marveling that human hands have made brilliant compositions, sculptures, and written books. Then Lucy says to him as he's looking at his potential-filled hands, they've got jam on them. And marketing director Jeffrey Potter says, maybe what I appreciate most about the strip is that I find nuances in the punchlines and storylines that have changed meanings for me depending on where I am in my life. As an adult, I can relate to Charlie Brown on so many levels. Let's bring on a caller now. Connie is with us in Portage. Connie, hi.
Hi. I'm 80 years old, and my roommate in college is in West Virginia, and we've kept up all this time. I just sent her a Snoopy and the Gang Christmas card that's musical. She sent me a wooden music box where it's the doghouse and Snoopy's laying on the top looking at the sky. And we went to a girls' college and lights were out at 10 o'clock. And we would take flashlights under the blankets and read all the comic strips of Snoopy in
there.
And my favorite is when Snoopy was lost in the grass. And he would jump way up high, and then he'd scream, and he'd jump again. That was always my favorite. But I like Lucy, too.
Connie, thank you so much for sharing that story. Andrew, when you kicked off this project, did you have people kind of coming out of the woodwork to tell their Charlie Brown stories?
I love that caller's story. And by the way, I do want to mention that the publisher of the book deserves a lot of credit. That's the Library of America. Mm-hmm. And also, just to answer your question, to go back to the genesis, I met Schulz 20 years ago in 1999. And I didn't realize at the time just how unusual it was to get an audience with him. It was like meeting the Wizard of Oz. And once we were able to get the project, get a publisher for it, to your question, yes, people started coming out of the woodwork, as you say, and again, apprehension, if you can call it that, was that there would be a homogeneity to it, that everybody would be writing similar stories. But wow, was that not the case at all? Because there's a piece about the music and the soundtrack. There's a piece about Sally. There's a lot about there's something about Franklin and Pigpen. I mean, it's not just all character studies. But yes, there are people like Ann Patchett in the book who says that probably she would have never become a writer had it not been for the strip. And for a lot of people, Snoopy was the first writer. And we forget somehow that he was a writer. Snoopy was unpublished, but it was a dark, stormy night. That's where he started.
Connie, thanks a lot. Andrew, you've met Charles Schulz. I hear that he was not a glory-seeking kind of guy in person, very self-effacing. Is that something that matched up with your impression of him?
Completely so. I wrote him a letter in 1999 asking him, a total shot in the dark, whether he would consider actually writing something for another book I was working on behalf of somebody else. And he wrote I expected just a form letter at best. And instead, I got this personal note saying he was declining writing for this other project. But if I ever find myself in Santa Rosa, California, please stop by. And I thought, are you kidding? Like the next day, I started planning a trip to happen to put me in Santa Rosa, California. And yes, absolutely, positively, his humility and humanity and sort of gentle humor, coupled with the melancholy and sort of existential angst that he had, was completely endearing and disarming and consistent with what we knew about him before.
Let's go back to our callers. Marilyn is with us in Washburn. Marilyn, hi.
Hey, hi, Robin, Andrew. What a fun book to look forward to. And Andrew, you just mentioned Santa Rosa, and that's what I'm calling about. I live in Washburn, Wisconsin, but I've gotten to go twice to that wonderful museum, the Charles Schulz Museum that's out in Santa Rosa. And it unfortunately did not actually finalized to become open until after his death, but it is all things Charlie Brown and the gang, and there are original sketches, there's his whole drawing table is there, and I just wanted to give a shout out about that's such a fun place to go for people who really love this. And an example, there had been a sketch about Christo and covering Snoopy's house as a Christo, and then Christo actually covers a doghouse, and it's out there in the museum.
Oh, wow.
It's like a Christo art piece. So there's just lots of fun things at that museum, and I can't wait to get a hold of your book. So thanks.
Thank you, and amen to what you said. I was fortunate enough to be out there at that museum for the first time. We did an event with Jonathan Franzen, actually, and it is everything you just described and more, and well worth the trip.
Marilyn, thanks for that call. We're talking to Andrew Blonner, editor of the Peanuts Papers, writers and cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and the Gang, and the Meaning of Life. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hello.
Hi there. One of the things about Charlie Brown cartoons for me was that, a lot of us guys resonate with Charlie Brown. I was a Charlie Brown. And reading those cartoons, it was like reading, somebody who understood my life. And just saying, this Charlie Brown ended up happily married with kids, having a good job, so it worked out.
But, Mark, it sounds like you found some comfort in somebody who's gone through, Charlie Brown, who's gone through some of the same struggles you were?
Hey, people pulled the football out from underneath me many times.
Okay. Mark, thank you. I'm glad things turned out well for you. But a lot of people identified, and you were saying this, a lot of people were fans and maybe identified, Andrew, with Charlie himself.
For sure. It was a surprise, but it was a pleasant surprise. I just thought everybody loves Snoopy. Everybody, has their personal favorite. But I just had no idea how many people not just had affection for Charlie Brown, but really identified. And people you might not think so much. And it was interesting because Schulz was on record as saying, of all the characters, if they had actually been real and grown up, who would have been the most likely to have sort of a happy, healthy, normal life? And he actually said it was probably Linus. But I think the people, other than Snoopy, the character that people most identified with was certainly Charlie Brown.
Our colleagues, thanks for that call. Our colleagues identified it a couple more. Jana Rose Schleiss, morning show producer, says she loved Lucy. She realizes now it's because Lucy was loud and bossy and unapologetic. Schulz didn't make them seem like bad characteristics, an important thing for a young, loud, and sometimes bossy Jana Rose to see. Let's talk about the character of Lucy a little bit. Is that somebody that among your contributors grabbed their attention much?
For sure. I'm glad that came up because God help us if we left Lucy out of what she would do to us. But we forget, too, that this was created, written largely in the 50s and 60s. And Schulz, he had a lot of – Lucy was a very strong, independent, woman, a little girl, 4 years old, some people would say, who happened to have, a psychiatry practice for 5 cents. But, one person's, bossy and difficult was another person's strong, independent, inspiring character. And one of the contributors in the book, Peter Kramer, who's a brilliant writer, wrote Listening to Prozac and several other bestsellers, I think for a lot of people, it was his introduction to that world of psychology, psychiatry, and therapy, and what that means, and Lucy's advice, you know, which in the book, it's sort of debated, not directly, but whether or not she gave good advice. I mean, her advice to Charlie Brown was snap out of it, which, you know, some people have said that's what he needed and that was good for him. But that was the other surprise, actually, in addition to Charlie Brown, of like how many people connected with and actually respected and admired Lucy.
Let's bring on John now, calling from La Crosse. John, hello.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
Well, I want to echo just what you were saying, because I grew up as a young boy, as with many baby boomer generation members of the 1950s and 60s, and I didn't think it was wrong or unusual at that time for me to identify with a young girl, even though I'm very much a man, to empathize with everything that Lucy was going through, because I grew up actively listening to people and coming from theater. I'm a stage manager, so I would learn how to tell people to snap out of it and to also actively listen to people when I needed to. And so I didn't think there was anything wrong about her being assertive or aggressive. It was just a way that many people, both boys and girls, men and women of the baby boom generation, saw that in order for them to become who they wanted to be, they had to snap out of it or assert themselves. Nothing wrong with that.
John, thanks for the call. Some more life lessons from Lucy there, Andrew.
For sure. And I'll just take the opportunity, since that caller mentioned being in the theater and stage manager, that I also learned during this process that the production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown is by far the most produced musical in American history. And the number of productions is at 40,000.
Wow.
And counting. And that over 250,000 people have, in one form or another, been in a production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown.
We're talking to Andrew Blauner right now. He's the founder of Blauner Books Literary Agency and editor of the Peanuts Papers, writers and cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and The Meaning of Life. We'll be back with Andrew after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Andrew Blauner. He's the editor of the Peanuts Papers, writers and cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and The Meaning of Life. It includes 33 reflections by well-known writers and artists, including Sarah Boxer, Ira Glass, Leslie Stein, and Ann Patchett. Back to your calls now. Jean with us then in Elkhorn. Jean, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about Jean?
I wanted to tell you about how peanuts became kind of a common language for six kids and our parents. We all read it. We all read, reread some. We actually had some books and things like that. So we had the common knowledge. And when someone was making a sandwich, if you got a knife out towards it, it was like, no, don't cut it, fold it over. Otherwise, all the flavor leaks out. The piece where Lucy says has five good reasons. I use that on my younger brother a lot.
She folded
in her fingers and made a fist. And the quotes have stuck with me forever. It was like a philosophy for our family. It was something we shared with each other and still do, for that matter.
Gina, thanks a lot for that call. I think a lot of people have that sort of family connection, bonding over the peanuts, Andrew.
Your caller put it, I agree. She put it so well, the philosophy for family and the common language. That's exactly sort of the message, in a way, that's something that, again, whether it was also like the Beatles or the Bible, some of the subjects of the other books that are put together, that in an increasingly, polarized world, that, it's to be cherished that there are things that we can have in common. And this is at the top of the list. So that's really touching to hear that from your caller.
Gene, thanks a lot for that call. That reminds me, one of your contributors, novelist Rick Moody, wrote about, speaking of the family connection, how his daughter took a quick liking to a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. He wrote that the special took on a lot of familiar Peanuts themes but had some poignant moments. For example, after Charlie Brown's Thanksgiving feast goes down badly, Marcy cheers him up. Here's a listen.
I don't feel bad for myself. I just feel bad because I ruined everyone's Thanksgiving.
But Thanksgiving is more than eating, Chuck. You heard what Linus was saying out there. Those early pilgrims were thankful for what had happened to them. And we should be thankful, too. We should just be thankful for being together.
So I brought up some of the darkness in Charlie Brown earlier, Andrew, but that's an example of what you brought up, too, that there's redemption and connection in it, too.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, that's just so sweet, isn't it? and Rick's piece, you know, a lot of people, you know, obviously the Halloween special and the Christmas special get sort of most of the attention and affection. But the Thanksgiving, you know, which is in between. And Rick writes about something that I think a lot of people experience, which is maybe they had their Peanuts life when they were kids and then it goes away for a while. And then when you have kids of your own, you re-experience it through their eyes. And I think Rick mentioned his daughter is basically addicted to the Thanksgiving special to the point that I think he's seen it 149 times.
We, again, asked around WPR. Morgan Stewart, our administrative coordinator, says, I'd love to hear from listeners and the guests about the characters of Franklin and Pigpen. How are they perceived by people when they first saw them? Morgan says, are any listeners aware that Franklin was the first black Peanuts character? And do they think, as I did when I was a child, that Pigpen was dirty because he was poorer than the rest of the gang? Any thoughts on Franklin and Pigpen, Andrew?
Well, that's an important point. Franklin, the same way that Schultz was sort of ahead of his time a little bit in making Lucy, for example, a strong, independent female character, he absolutely was the first to have an African-American or black character in a comic strip. And it was as a result of a letter that he got from a school teacher in California in 1968 or 69 suggesting that he do it. And Schultz was sort of notorious for if you suggested something to him, it was a surefire thing he wouldn't do it because everything sort of had to come from his own mind. But he made an exception for this. And I think a lot of people benefited from that. And one of the contributors in the book is Jennifer Finney Boylan. And she writes about sort of a group or a class of the characters. I think she sort of puts under the umbrella of outsiders. And in there is Peppermint Patty, who's arguably a lesbian, Franklin, Marcy, Pigpen. So, again, the fallacy is that it's all about Charlie Brown and Lucy and Linus and Snoopy. But, you know, he had a good bench there.
Let's go back to our callers now. Deborah is with us in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hello. Let's not forget Woodstock.
Mm.
When I was growing up, I had a Snoopy bedspread, a Snoopy, a Peanuts wastebasket, Snoopy and Peanuts sheets. I get cards every holiday are Snoopy cards. And I took a picture and sent them to you. But it would be Snoopy dancing, and he would have his neck up, and he would be smiling. And it said, keep smiling. It makes people wonder what you've been up to.
Deborah, a big Snoopy. I also had the bed sheets and a pillowcase, I think. And I remember drawing pictures on a big piece of paper of the house that lived underneath Snoopy's doghouse, because at some points he describes this huge, basically underground mansion, things like that. Thanks, Deborah. Some people, as you thought, some people really do have that Snoopy connection, Andrew.
Well, yeah, and Snoopy also in that doghouse had a Van Gogh and I think an Andrew Wyeth painting, and actually Schultz clearly had an issue with that because people would – Schultz, you know, I don't know if it's a Midwestern thing or it was his melancholy or insecurity despite all the fame and success, because there was a certain point where if people were heaping too much praise on him, he'd say, yes, but I'm no Andrew Wyeth. But the Woodstock thing is funny too. When I got to meet Schultz, for some reason, one of the questions I asked him was whether Woodstock was male or female, which to this day, anytime I've mentioned that to someone, they think it's a ludicrous question because he was so obviously male. But I don't know. I'm still not totally convinced.
Did Charles Schultz have an answer?
He didn't. He sort of hedged. I asked him that, and I asked him what was Franklin's last name, and he didn't know. And I said, well, if you don't know, then nobody knows. And then afterwards it became Armstrong, actually, because we knew Brown and Van Pelt and some of the other characters' last names.
Back to our callers now. We've got Marcus with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, so I have pictures up in my kids' room now that hung in my brother's in my bedroom when we were growing up, that hung in my dad's bedroom when he was growing up. And they're these, they're on fabric, and it's, you know, different colors, and there's just a single character with a little, you know, like speech bubble above it. And so you have Linus saying, "No problem is so big or so complicated that it can't be run away from." And then you have one with Snoopy, you know, with his fist in the air on top of the doghouse that says, "Curse you, Red Baron." And one with Charlie Brown sitting on the curb and says, "I developed a new philosophy. I only dread one day at a time." But, you know, that whole familial connection. And one of the other things about the specials, I really like the one where Snoopy is up flying against the Red Baron, and then the Red Baron forces him down, and then they sing Christmas carols.
Marcus, thank you so much. Great memories there. And he's decorating now his kids' room, Andrew.
Well, exactly. And again, my kid, who's five and to whom the book is dedicated, Sam, he has a Snoopy pillowcase, which he'll be putting his head on, hopefully, in the next hour or two.
Thanks for the call, Marcus. Just a couple minutes left. Andrew, there was no question after Charles Schulz passed away that anybody else is going to do this strip, right? Some cartoonists, there's a succession plan. It was done with him.
Exactly, for sure. And not only that, but Schulz made it clear during his life that he really wasn't interested in getting involved in politics or using his fame or platform for other purposes. And he basically was saying, anything I have to say, I say through the strip and through my characters. And sure enough, that once he was in ill health, he had to announce that he was going to stop drawing the strip. And yes, he made it very clear nobody was going to continue it. But he, some of your listeners may know, he died within 24 hours of when the last strip was published, as if something almost karmically was at play there. So that's just sort of another sort of mystical, meaningful part of Peanuts lore.
And just briefly, Andrew, do you have a favorite character that you connect with?
You know, sometimes you get that kind of question with other projects, and, oh, I love them the same, and they're all like my children. But no, it's Snoopy forever for
Snoopy
me.
All the way. Andrew, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Blauner is the founder of Blauner Books Literary Agency and editor of several anthologies. We talked with him about his latest book, The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and the Gang, and the Meaning of Life. Coming up, we learned about some Wisconsin place names and talk about the importance of preserving native languages. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We've received several questions on the next topic from listeners, including Judy Olson from Bailey's Harbor and Emily Brookheiser from Madison. Here's Emily with her question.
Where does the word "wah" in a lot of Wisconsin city names come from? For example, Wausau, Waukesha, and Wanakee all start with "wah," and I'm wondering what language that comes from and what it means.
To go about answering this question, we called up a couple of experts. Monica McCauley is a professor of language sciences at UW-Madison and is affiliated faculty with the university's American Indian Studies program. She works with the Menominee and their language revitalization and reclamation programs. Monica, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian McInnes is an associate professor of civil society and community studies in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Brian's a native Ojibwe speaker, enrolled member of the Ojibwe Nation, and a descendant of the Wisconsin Potawatomi tribe. Brian, welcome to the show.
I'm here. Thank you so much.
Wonderful.
I think we
lost you there for just a sec. Well, I wanted to ask each of you, before we get into this question of the "wah" part of names, I wanted to ask each of you about work that you're doing with native language preservation and revitalization. Brian, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on?
Sure. And one of the things that I'm really pleased and excited about is I will be taking over the Ojibwe language program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So very complimentary to my work in language immersion education, as well as storytelling traditions in northern Wisconsin communities.
And Monica, same question. What kind of work are you doing?
I'd say the most exciting work that I'm doing is working with the Menominee. they've started a new immersion daycare. And for the first time in a very long time, you've got little tiny babies learning to speak Menominee as their first language. So that's very exciting.
Now, for a little background before we dig into the question at hand, Brian, can you tell us a little bit about the variety of native languages that have been and currently are spoken in the Wisconsin area?
Yeah, Wisconsin is, you know, a very exciting state in terms of its linguistic diversity. You know, we have in northern parts of the state, we certainly have Ojibwe widely spoken, but also, as Monica's indicated, Menominee, one of our cousin languages, Potawatomi or Bodewadmi, is also a very dynamic and important language in our state. But then we also have languages from other indigenous nations, such as, you know, the Ho-Chunk people. And, of course, in Madison, Wisconsin, we're very respectful of the Ho-Chunk and their traditional territory here. We have Oneida language, which is also a very significant and historic language in Wisconsin. So we're quite fortunate to have that kind of dynamic vibrancy in our state.
And Monica, Brian mentioned a couple of the languages on that list were cousins. I understand some of them are very far separated. I've seen people say, yeah, some of them are as closely related as German and Chinese, for example.
Well, Menominee, Potawatomi, and Ojibwe are all from the same language family. So it would be like being an Indo-European language or something like that. Ho-Chunk is Siouan. And Oneida is Iroquoian, and they are completely unrelated families.
All right, now let's get to the question that started us off here, this WA syllable that appears from Milwaukee to Wauwatosa to Wausau and beyond. And I understand the answer isn't as simple as I might have thought it would have been. Where do you want to start on this, Brian?
Sure. You know, it's one of the things with, I think, when you think of the location of where these places are and then think of the traditional groups of Native people who would have occupied each of those locations. And in so many cases, I think, as Monica was indicating, you know, we do have Algonquin-speaking peoples who were in a number of those areas. So, but again, it becomes the challenge of, I think, every place name researcher to try to figure out what might have gone awry in the way the name was first written down, and as importantly, the way the name gets said today. So that's usually an interesting starting place when we're trying to determine what was the original place name and what was the meaning behind that place name. Does that sound right, Monica?
That totally sounds right. I've been spending my day, it was really a lot of fun because I'm a big word nerd, and I've been spending my day looking at this wonderful book by Virgil Vogel called Indian Names on Wisconsin's Map. And he did a lot of the work for us. And basically the answer to the question is, nope, there's no relationship. The WA, it's just chance that they start with WA.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And is part of that, Monica, the translation issue, maybe there were a bunch of different words, maybe in different languages that, say, English settlers or maybe French settlers, depending on the timing, kind of all heard and lumped together as that WA syllable?
No, in each case, there's a pretty clear etymology for it. So Wausau, for example, comes from the Ojibwe word for far away or distant. Brian, how would you say that yourself?
I would say Wausau.
Wausau, yeah. So that's probably what it comes from. And then Wanaki, now this one I don't know. And Brian, you can tell me if this makes any sense to you. What Vogel says is that he says it's possibly from Wanaki, I inhabit a place in peace.
And that is, you know, I think that's one of the interesting things when we're working at reconstructing a meaning in a word from some map by someone's, I guess, iteration or version of that. I would agree that could be a meaning of it. It could also be a place where somebody got lost, too. So
oh, really?
It's also a possibility, Wanaki, you know, getting lost on one's journey upon the earth. So who knows? But that's also times when you have the place name without the story to go with it. It's sometimes hard to contextualize what the person actually meant to say.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Brian, any other names? We've got a lot of cities with that WA syllable. Any others that stand out to you as you know, possible sources of their meanings?
Sure. And, you know, one of the things I think, especially when you drive through the greater, you know, Milwaukee area, the place names there, you really see the richness of especially the Potawatomi historic influence there. And so when you're, you know, and like as Monica said, a word nerd, or like I'm very much that myself, you know, trying to read through, wondering what does that actually mean? What is the, so it actually becomes a little dangerous driving through there sometimes because there's so many fantastic words. But, you know, when you figure one out, there's this incredibly, you feel like you've just done something amazing, like you just figured out this puzzle. And a lot of times in Algonquin languages in particular, you know, the wa can refer to, you know, flashes of light or brightness. And so when you hear the Wauwatosa, and it makes you think of, you know, the old Potawatomi word for firefly, and that kind of, especially with the reduplicated, the double wa, it refers to something which might be flashing or intermittent in its frequency. So it's something, you know, bright and some kind of light, or, you know, beautiful effervescence coming off something. So it's actually, for a place name to have that meaning or association, it would be a very positive kind of meaning. So that's usually most welcome.
Well, that's really interesting. So it's, you know, in my head, I thought it, you know, wa would be like water or place or something like this one word, but it sounds like, Monica, not only is it not that, it also, there might be layers of symbolism or metaphor built up in these names as well.
It might be very simple. So the book that I was looking at, Vogel, didn't have an explanation for Waukesha. And I looked around on the web, and it looks like it probably comes from the Potawatomi word for fox. And I'm not sure I can pronounce this right, but it's something like Waukesha. What is it in Ojibwe, Brian?
Would be Waugush.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
That's in the ballpark. Okay, so that might be a case, do you think, Brian, where it was named after a particular word?
Oh, very much so. And, you know, so many places may also, you know, derive their meaning from, you know, the historic shared tribal or indigenous legacy of the state. You know, we know for, you know, hundreds of years, different tribal groups have made Wisconsin their home or been through Wisconsin. And, you know, even the legacy of their presence and their history in the state may be reflected in some of these place names. I often think of Madison, you know, our wonderful four lakes here. You know, when you think of Wingra, you know, place of many ducks, the Ho-Chunk name, and you think of, you know, like Monona, which, you know, has been rumored to be an Algonquin name, but you know, we really had to think about that before we finally, you know, were able to derive Minonaguet, a lake of beautiful appearing water, to even Mendota, which might be derived from a Dakota name. So I think these place names, they refer as much to, you know, the present contemporary uses of these places or ways that we know them to the historic occupations of tribal groups.
Well, in a way, I want to, you know, get a time machine and go back and learn the stories. But in a way, and here's where I want to wrap up, I want to ask both of you about the value of talking about these languages in the present tense as living languages now. Brian, let's start with you.
I think it's especially in the present when language revitalization is so important to all Indigenous peoples in Minnesota that, you know, learning Indigenous languages, promoting Indigenous languages, you know, really there could be nothing more quintessentially American than that. That is our original shared history and one that we can all be proud of and can all learn and celebrate together.
And Monica, your thoughts on the present and future of Native languages?
I think one of the most moving things I ever heard was at a meeting where a young woman whose language had not been spoken for a while, but who was working towards bringing it back, said that when she heard the word extinct, it made her feel horrible. And she sort of stood there and then she just said, "I am not extinct." And it's so much to do with identity. It's an incredibly important piece of people's identity. And that's why it's really important to keep them going.
We'll leave it there for now. Monica, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Brian, thanks for being with us.
Miigwech. Thank you.
That's Monica McCauley, professor of language sciences at UW-Madison, and Brian McInnes, associate professor of civil society and community studies, also at UW-Madison. We talked to them today about the roots of Wisconsin place names that have WAU, W-A-U, in them.